The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to episode 526 with my guest, Dr. David Rossmarin. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is Mental Illness Happy Hour. We're just trying to get our shit together. That's all. We're just locking hands and saying, how the fuck do we get through this? I have been having some trouble getting out of bed. I don't know if it's because of the whole rheumatoid arthritis thing. Sometimes when I first wake up in the morning, I'll feel like this stabbing pain in my wrists or down my legs or in my ankles. And it's not like it's nonstop, but it's fleeting moments of it. And it, the first place I go to in my head is my body is trying to destroy itself. And it's a fucked up feeling when the enemy is inside your body. I can't imagine what people must go through that have cancer or something that's terminal. It's got to be so hard to make peace with it. And I'm trying to make peace with it. I'm trying to do what I can, watch my diet and stuff like that. But every little new creak in a joint or pain that I feel, the Catastrophizer 4000, which I had in my brain before this, has certainly got a lot of shit to think about. A couple of days ago, I was, for some reason, this guy popped into my head that I knew from high school. He had taken a job in right out of high school in a quarry, like a union job, and he was making great money. And we were just all like, oh my God, this guy's got so much money. He's got a pension. And I was just thinking, where is he today? Is he still working at that job? Is he retired? Does he have a pension? And God, I hope he's not one of those people whose pension gets pilfered by some fucking psychopath, and then they got to work the rest of their days. And then I started thinking about my retirement, and am I going to have enough money to retire? And what happens if I get bilked out of money by somebody who's supposed to pay me money? And I was imagining, what am I going to do if somebody fucks me over? Well, I guess I'll threaten to talk about it publicly. That's like the only leverage I have is I'll spread the word about how bad their corporation is. And so then I'm imagining me talking on the phone with them and them saying, well, that's blackmail. And then I'd say, no, it's not, because I'm not asking for additional money, just the money that you owe me. And then they'd say that they didn't see it that way, and they'd threaten me with a lawsuit, and then I'd have to use up what little money I already had left, and then I wouldn't be able to afford my medicine, and my legs would start hurting more, and I'm getting pissed. And all of this is 5 minutes after waking up. I'm still laying in bed, and I'm fucked before I even put my slippers on. It is sometimes... it is a full-time job being a worry wart. Anyway, I hope you dig our our episode today with Dr. Ross Maron. Before we get to it, I want to read a couple of surveys. And before we do that, I want to remind you one of our sponsors for this this episode is BetterHelp.com online counseling. As you can gather from the first 5 minutes of this podcast, I need counseling, and I use BetterHelp, and I love my therapist, Donna. She's awesome. She gets my brand of crazy, and she helps me, and she's compassionate and knowledgeable. And BetterHelp, that's BetterHelp.com, has a huge variety of counselors. So just go to BetterHelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire, and if they feel that they have a counselor who's a good match for you, they'll pair you up with one, and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's your thing. And you need to be over 18. Okay, a couple of surveys. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, and a woman who calls herself Pocket describes her ADHD. It feels like putting together a puzzle that, unbeknownst to me, is actually six different puzzles. It is so fucking good. Oh my God, that's so good. This guy who calls himself Beanie Boo about his anxiety, he writes, it's like accidentally falling into a hole which is slightly too deep to jump and grab the edge and climb out of, while people with ladders constantly walk by and briefly glance at you. God. Any comments to make the podcast better? Bedtime stories. Once upon a time, there was a boy who lived in a shoe. He lived on a street filled with shoe houses, but he always felt different because his family's house was an orthotic shoe. He wished and wished that his house could be like the others. He was tired of being teased. He was sad. His grandmother, who had lived in the shoe since she was a little girl, said, Jacques, did you know there are people who don't even have a shoe to call home? Why are you calling me Jacques? Oh, she said, I thought you were Jacques. This lighting is awful. See, he said, this shoe sucks. She pulled him close and hugged him. Did you know that when I was your age, I felt the very same way? I wanted nothing more than to live in a regular shoe like everyone else, or at least a comfortable loafer. Tears came to his eyes. But I'm so sad. I just want to be like everyone else. But she said, if you were like everyone else, you wouldn't be special. I'm special? You better believe it, Bucko. I'm not Bucko. God damn this lighting. Who am I talking to? Eric. Ah. Well, that complicates things, Eric. Am I special? Of course. How? Give me a minute. Several minutes passed. Ah, I know you're special because you tell the truth even when we don't want to hear it. Well, I hate living here. I want to run away and never come home. His grandmother knelt down and looked him in the belt and said, you're 26. You're free to do as you please, but it would break our hearts if you ran away. We love you more than you could ever know. Really? Yes, she said. Now take your Depakote. I hope you like that. And then finally, one more survey before we get to the interview. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Birthday Girl, and she writes, my mom passed away unexpectedly the morning after my 18th birthday. My dad and I were the ones that found her. As we sat on the couch processing what was going on, police, paramedics, and other first responders were coming in and out of the house. One firefighter came in and noticed a large happy birthday balloon floating by the front door and asked very sweetly if it had been someone's birthday. My dad quickly responded with a smile, yeah, it was her 18th birthday yesterday, pointing at me. What a great birthday present this is, and started laughing. He then turned to me and said, happy birthday, and continued laughing. You should have seen the look on the firefighter's face. Shortly after, my dad and I were split up, and I was questioned by a police officer as to why my dad slept on the couch that night. I explained that he snored, and it was common for my mom to kick him out of the bedroom. However, I watch enough crime shows that it was most likely my dad's behavior that prompted the interrogation. It's been 8 years, and happy birthday still doesn't sound the same since that day.
I just wanted to get the fuck away from my life.
You know, I couldn't have felt any lower.
Grief, guilt, shame.
Why wasn't I born a girl?
There's a switch that gets flipped in my head.
I'm supposed to be a girl.
I experience being treated like an animal.
How can a just God...
I have a vomit fetish.
...let humans do this to each other?
Help!
I fucking flew over the cuckoo's nest.
My wife's losing it.
I thought it was all about me.
I don't know what to do.
I would have committed suicide if I could have watched my funeral.
A Polaroid I found of my mother, naked in a dentist chair.
And my body doesn't quite...
I think I did 8 days in L.A. County Jail.
...fit how I see myself.
What was it all for? Why are my friends dead?
Everything that I did...
There's a comfort in the scars for me.
...was in service of OCD.
You've already had all the paper cuts. Step away from the paper.
It's really hard to see the picture when you're inside the frame.
You know, it takes a larger view to see your life.
Just actually have somebody listen to you.
Yeah. And I got up and got my tooth and left.
I'm here with Dr. David Rosmarin, who is director of spirituality and mental health at McLean Hospital. You're an assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And one of the topics that we're going to talk about is denial, which obviously is extremely timely in today's climate. But I think also in general, I think a lot of people also have personal issues with maybe somebody in their life that just you can't wrap your head around why they can't see things as other people see them. Where do, first of all, welcome and where do we begin?
Thanks for having me on your show. Where do we begin? I think in some ways, you know, as you said, you know, denial, it's definitely rife today. It's all over the place, whether it's regarding the pandemic, the idea that it doesn't really exist. You know, maybe up until 2 weeks ago, the idea that that Biden was president, there's just a lot of people denying aspects of reality. Climate change is another great example.
Yeah.
Great example. It's just not a problem. It's just not a happening. When our experiences tell us otherwise. And,
right.
You know, I've been kicking around some ideas with my colleagues here. And I don't really know. I mean, there's not a lot of great research on denial, but I'll tell you where some of the conversations have gone, which has been kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The first point is that denial is actually a natural and maybe even in some regards healthy process that people engage in when they are experiencing distress. When there's aspects of reality that we don't like to face, there's different strategies we can use to cope with that. One of them is just pretending that, well, it's just, that just doesn't exist.
Right.
And it's not always necessarily so bad.
Give me some examples, because my mind is blanking right now on it. Would it, for example, be growing up with a parent who is unsafe and you have to deny that so that you can live with the reality that you're not trapped?
Yeah, unsafe is a tough example because, you know, then, you know, there's always at some point diminishing returns. But living with somebody who's just a difficult person,
mm-hmm.
Having
what would the benefit of that be though?
One of the benefits is that it can enable us to maintain our connection in that situation long enough that we can figure out what to do about it. And if we were to come into contact with all aspects of reality all at once, I think it would be overwhelming.
That's true.
You know, I myself, being perfectly honest, I think I engaged in a fairly significant amount of denial at the beginning of the pandemic. I don't know about you, but I'm like, yeah, this will be over in a month.
Mm-hmm.
It can't possibly be longer than that.
I think the big one is I'm too healthy for it to affect me. Even if I do get
sure.
it, I'll bounce right back. And then I think we see enough people near our age group die to certainly question that.
Sure, 100%. Some degree of denial, though, can be, you know, the example you're giving, I think, might be less advantageous. But in terms of coping, you know, I will take your example from before. You mentioned about, you know, someone who's in an unsafe relationship. Sometimes people just can't handle the fact that they have a loved one who's doing something which is dangerous to them. And they need to get some emotional and cognitive distance from that in order to function day to day until they can be strong enough to actually deal with the situation.
That makes sense. And do you believe that's probably part of the evolutionarily developed brain?
Who knows where it comes from? But, you know, I do think that it's an aspect of life that, if we're all being honest, we all engage in to some degree. I think we're very quick to pathologize. And there's a lot of people pointing fingers saying, like, how can people deny climate change? How can people deny the presidency? How can people deny, you know, COVID? And I don't think that's fair, because everybody, again, to some degree, engages in these denial processes. And it could be that there's certain aspects of COVID that are so emotionally dysregulating that some people, the only way that they can deal with it is by disconnecting from aspects of reality.
Yeah. I imagine most of us by this time have already heard stories that nurses or doctors will tell, where someone is breathing their last breaths, dying from COVID, and saying, "I don't have it. I don't have it."
Sure. Sure. I think we've all heard stories like that. And, you know, I guess it, like anything in life, it can be used for good or it can be used for evil. And I think that there, you know, in psychological terms, it can be used in positive ways, and it can be used in negative ways, in ways that are maladaptive.
I live in an area where there are a lot of temples, and I was walking past one of them yesterday, and I saw the, you know, the typical security patrol parked outside there. And I turned to my girlfriend and I said, you know, the climate that we're living in is probably nothing new to people who are Jewish, that there has always been this thing hanging over their head of, you know, people denying the Holocaust, people who make up reasons to be paranoid about Jewish people. What do you think or feel when you see somebody denying the Holocaust?
It's a really good question. You know, as somebody who's Jewish myself, and, you know, and Orthodox, or religiously Jewish at that, I can't say that it doesn't sting, but at the same time, I understand it as, well, let's actually, this is an interesting example. When it comes to Holocaust denial, the purpose there isn't to, it's not a psychological, if you will, defense to not confront reality. That's actually an attack mechanism in order to undermine an aspect of history for the, if you will, you know, they're trying to construct a purpose of perpetuating and increasing anti-Semitism. So that's not a, you know,
that's a different brand.
That's a different type of denial. That's not, yeah. That's more on the psychopathy line, where someone is, oh, I never did anything to you. And, you know, They're causing them harm every day. Like on a kind of like gaslighting kind of thing. And I guess there's a denial piece to it, but that's more for purposes of causing harm. So I see that as fundamentally different. Yeah. But I have met people who are just like, I can't imagine that happen. I can't fathom something like that happening.
Which I think is different, you know, like 9/11,
right.
I had to watch the footage 50 times because my brain could not absorb that it was real. I knew it happened.
But, you saw it.
Yeah, I saw it, but I couldn't digest it.
that's an aspect of denial. That's and your way of dealing with it was, don't deny, I have to face reality by watching it multiple times, which is fine. That's a fine approach. Probably a good approach, I would say, in that case.
How often when you're going into temple does the thought occur to you that some type of violence could be inflicted?
Not often at all. Firstly, I mean, this last year, you know, going to temple, going to synagogue is not a huge part of my schedule,
right.
Just because of quarantine restrictions and whatnot. And my family's taking it pretty seriously. We're not denying COVID. But prior to that, I'll be honest, not a whole lot. You mentioned the beginning. So my primary area of expertise in the spirituality and health. And I think, drawing on spiritual resources is certainly something that helps me to, you know, grapple with that uncertain unknown. And there's data that I'm not the only one, you know, I see that in my studies all the time, that, it can be a resource.
And I would agree finding, a source greater than myself to deal with my addictions, to cope with my problems. Some people might say, well, you're living in a fantasy world, and
that's denial, right?
Yeah. Or it's possibly true that there isn't something out there that I can tap into, but at the very least, it's a handy tool for me to fool myself. I don't believe I'm fooling myself. It gives me strength. It brings me comfort. And I believe it's one with science, because for me, it's energy. It's, you know, where does the energy of love come from? That's what I try to connect to, rather than getting into hate and wanting to try to control things that I don't have any power over, and, you know, trying to be of service where I can. I know it's kind of a big question, but talk about spirituality, not only in your life, but in the mental health realm.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly run into what you said before, that idea that, oh, it's a denial of reality to be spiritual. And I disagree, and primarily because there's certainly no proof that there isn't something spiritual.
Right.
You know, people say, well, there's no proof that there is. Well, there's certainly no proof that there isn't. And if anything, the order and design in the universe to me is quite palpable. I think, whether it's an evolutionary process or otherwise, it's pretty amazing that, you know, all human beings have a relatively similar look to them. We have five fingers. We have an opposing thumb. We have the ability to do certain things. It's pretty, to me, it seems miraculous. And, you know, whether someone chooses to see that as random or as designed, I think that's more a matter of perspective than one being denial and one being true. I think that that's really a choice and a matter of perspective taking.
Mm-hmm.
So I see it as somewhat orthogonal to our current discussion on denial. But here's something I will tell you, though. Many patients I've met and dealt with clinically, and the research does bear this out as well, will struggle to deal with aspects of their lives, but harnessing a spiritual perspective, a spiritual take, will help them to actually come into, to confront the reality that they're facing.
And in what way and what thoughts specifically are they inviting spirituality in?
I'll give you a case example, just one that's coming to mind. In fact, a family I met with this very morning, where the father is really struggling with a very significant stressor of a family member, who actually that family member is really in denial, and it's causing this father extreme stress and extreme distress. because he's sort of left dealing with the fallout of this other individual's denial. And there's very significant financial and other fallout, medical, many a social fallout, many aspects of it. It really is a taxing issue. And I found that the father I was speaking to, his emotions, he was very separated from his emotions. He really wasn't processing how he felt. He was very, whenever we spoke, very task oriented. What are we going to do? How are we going to fix the problem? Mm-hmm. And he wasn't able to really feel his feelings, to share his feelings, to experience them. And I think he's making, in some ways, bad decisions in managing it because he can't regulate his affect. And I encouraged him to think about it in spiritual terms and even to pray about it. And he froze in session. He's like, it's just too raw. It's just too raw for me. And I said, give it a try. Give it a try. And he didn't pray in our session, but we were in touch later in the day, and he had clearly engaged in some sort of a spiritual process. And I think it gave him the strength to be able to face the really challenging circumstances that he's having, circumstances that I myself would not be able to handle.
What forms can spirituality take for people?
Oh, there's many. I mean, you know, just as there's more than many forms of anything else in life, you know, spirituality has many forms. Common ones are the idea that there's a higher power or God, that higher power or God's on your side, and that, mm-hmm. you know, you have an ally, spiritual ally who knows what's going on, right? The concept of omniscience, who has the ability to help, the omnipotence concept. These are very, you know, these are taken from various traditions, not only the Jewish tradition, which I'm most familiar with, but these are common core spiritual concepts, which are really any world religion, and non-religious spiritual traditions have these in common to some degree. The idea of praying to, well, it's not an idea, the behavior of praying to that entity and seeking help, whether it's a request or simply speaking one's mind to that entity to try to share a burden.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of the things that's been helpful to me when I feel really overwhelmed by things in my life is, even though I don't believe that there's a dude in the sky that's listening to me,
right.
I believe letting go of energy, even if it's negative, and especially if you're coming from a place of I am powerless, and whatever force is there possibly in the universe, I need to connect with that. And, you know, people talk about a relationship with your higher power. And to me, any relationship is going to have conversations that aren't pleasant. And so there are times when I will yell, I can't handle this. Why are you doing this to me? Please, sure. Please help me with this. I can't take this anymore. And there, I do find some relief in doing that.
You're definitely not alone. Many a biblical figure has, you know, shared his or her pain with their higher power.
I kind of interrupted your thought. Do you remember where you were?
No,
headed?
I think you didn't interrupt. I think you added to it. I think the we're talking about different forms of spiritual life. So the idea of believing in something, praying to that entity. Another concept is finding meaning making. What is it what is our spiritual task in life? What are we here to accomplish? Do we have a job or jobs? What are those? And how does our current situation, whether it's stressful or otherwise, fit in? I think if people took these approaches to the current situations that we were speaking about before, denial would be mitigated, and we'd also have better control, emotional control, by and large, with potential exceptions.
How important do you think community is in having a spiritual life?
Good question. It's one I get all the time, right? How do you sort of separate the spiritual versus communal aspects of religious life, for example, as an effect. Having a spiritual faith community is, to me, and my data does bear this out to some degree, and certainly others who've even studied it to a greater degree than I have, is that faith communities are fundamentally psychologically different than non-faith communities, in that the bonds which unite faith communities are, I'll call them vertical as well as horizontal. We have social connections, but then there's also a vertical, if you will, a spiritual connection which links members of that faith community together.
And this doesn't necessarily have to be religious. It could just be a commonly shared belief.
It could be, although when we talk about communities, typically it is a religious group. But statistically, it's more likely to be than a spiritual, non-religious group. Although in theory, I suppose if you had a group of like-minded spiritualists who engage in whatever it is that they do without specific religious practice, I think that probably could be the same. But in any event, that spiritual uniting force might prompt one to ask questions like, why is this person in my community? Why were they brought to me? Why was I brought to them? What do we have to teach each other? What's the spiritual, latent spiritual meaning behind our connection? How can we grow together in a way that actually isn't just friends, but we're really perpetuating a spiritual mission of the world? Which are larger questions, right?
Right.
Not just, here's my coworker, Bob, and, we have a project together.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of times spirituality, and especially organized religion, is merely viewed as something that's about worship, which to me is the least important aspect of it, and the part that historically, certainly in the Catholic world, was the grandiosity, the pomp and circumstance were kind of ways to intimidate the people and to gain a semblance of control. Not completely, but certainly elements of that. Historically, the facts show that. And for many people who worship isn't an important part of it, and I would include myself in one of them. Sure. It's really about meaning and purpose, and the comfort is a byproduct of that, rather than just seeking it for comfort. When I'm stuck in traffic, God, please,
right,
ease up the flow of traffic so I can get to my appointment on time because I really want to book this job. That to me is not the brand of spiritual. But, for some people, hey, if that works and then traffic opens up and you feel a sense of comfort and that something's listening to you, that's great. But for me, it has to be something greater than that, and it can't just involve my needs.
I think there are many diverse ways to experience and express spiritual life. Sort of getting back to the main topic here on denial, I think these are some ways that people can confront aspects of reality that are otherwise very difficult. I'm thinking of other patients that I've seen, people from who have been through war, for example, veterans, who will come back, and sometimes they're even told by their superiors, don't speak to your wife, don't speak to your friends about what you saw, about what you did. They're not going to understand. Keep it bottled up. And they really don't have an outlet. And spirituality and religion, in many cases, is the only outlet that they have. They don't have anywhere else to speak about, to review, to sort of have a post-traumatic processing of their experiences. And without that, it can, even with it, it's not often not enough, but without it, it can be extremely painful, because they'll create too much emotional and cognitive distance from their memories, and then they come back to haunt them in pretty significant ways.
Yeah, and the isolating, which is often, a coping mechanism of people who are dealing with trauma, and it really, in my opinion, kind of exacerbates the struggle that they have and reinforces, it's home field advantage for the darkness. Have you ever read the book of What It's Like to Go to War by Carl Marlantes?
I have not. Tell me about it.
It is a fantastic book. And he talks about, the act of killing and how it takes us from innocent people to, I wouldn't use the word monster, but the phrase he says is it's finishing school for us. In other words, that darkness is already there. And, the shadow self already exists. And it's not the people, everybody has a propensity for wanting to kill, but it's that darkness and that thrill, even if you're horrified by your own actions, that thrill of doing it is already there a lot more than people would like to admit.
Wow, that's really profound.
Yeah, and again, I am paraphrasing.
Yeah, even paraphrase, that's a profound idea. I think what you're speaking to actually is that there are aspects of ourselves that we're not even aware of. And even just thinking about that's pretty terrifying. The only way to deal with that is to deny it.
Yeah.
Until you can't. Until reality just, then you have to face it. You just have to face the music, but that's what it is.
Go ahead.
No.
Okay. Another thing that he shared in his book is, he talks about there are all of these ceremonies for sending a soldier off to war, but we have none when they come back. And he talked about, as a man, how important it would have been for him to have female comfort and tenderness when he came back, and there was none of it. It's a really profound book that I recommend everybody read.
Thanks for the tip.
Yeah. What else would you like to talk about?
Well, I think that, in some ways, a main message is that denial is a process that we all engage in, and pointing fingers at those who are denying today is when I hear people doing that, and I've seen it written, and some of my colleagues have even done that. I by myself have probably done it at times. It's not. I don't think it really. Fully captures the psychological phenomena that we're seeing. I think that to some degree, we all engage in denial. We all need to engage in denial at times. It is a way of, in some ways, dealing with reality, giving us time. It gives us time to be able to process reality. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, although it can have negative consequences, of course. And I think if someone is denying and denying aspects of life, then we need to be more validating, compassionate, and understanding, as opposed to judging and looking down upon such people.
You were talking about one of the clients you had who was intellectualizing things. And one of my experiences, especially with people in my support group community, one of the biggest hindrances for them coming to believe that there could be something greater than themselves with some type of plan that they may be a part of is their intellect. And one of the things that I personally had to do to get to a place where I could even consider that something exists with all the horror that there is in the world was I had to let my intellect go and say, what if there is something? Let me act as if there is some type of positive matrix in the world that I can tap into, that whether I'm right or wrong, just let me try it. And that was a big step for me. And as I look at people, who are denying the election and, look at certain political figures that seem just unimaginably destructive to our society. I think that for these people, facts don't matter because there's some type of emotional resonance that is stirred in them that overrides intellect. And I believe that emotional energy can always override intellectual energy. Is there any science to bear that out, or am
that's certainly the case. I mean, we have the middle part of our brain is it contains the amygdala and surrounding areas, which are emotion regulation centers, and those when they are activated, it's very hard to for a person to access their cortex, which is more in the front or outer layers of the brain. And that's where your thinking processes. Very much so. And everybody, I'm sure, listening to this can relate that when your emotions are running really high, when a person's angry, you stop thinking. When a person's very anxious, very sad or despondent, your thinking changes. And you can't access certain aspects of reality. It's just too much. It's just too intense. And the emotions that we experience, I think what you're saying is spot on. That, when the only one caveat I would say is that all of us have a propensity and vulnerability to experience that.
I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was playing hockey, and this guy cheap shotted me. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Slapshot, but there's this scene where two guys are skating in opposing directions and one guy sticks his arms, straight out and catches the guy in the neck and just clotheslines him. And this guy did that to me and I saw red. And so I went after this guy and the ref stepped in and my arms were pulled behind my back and I spit at him because it was the only thing that I could do. And I wound up hitting the ref in the face with my spit and getting suspended for 5 games.
Yeah,
and
you're out.
Yeah. And so my teammates joked about that and I was really ashamed, but I understand what that feels like to be completely helpless and disrespected, at least in that moment. And
sure.
It's a terrifying feeling when you see red and you become a person that you do not like.
I think it's an experience that many people can relate to, whether it's anger or whether it's anxiety or whatever it is. And that could be what people are experiencing when it comes to the coronavirus, or when it comes to other aspects of life right now.
Did we finish your thought on, you were talking about communities and you talked about the vertical and the horizontal. Did we finish that? I think so.
I think my main point there was that the spiritual communities, I think, can be fundamentally different than non-spiritual communities, in that they can link people, they can have both spiritual and social meaning to them. And I think that first layer is unique.
And how about for people who, let's say people who are in a grief support group, they're not worshiping a similar deity, but there is a bond there of understanding and mutual experience.
Yeah. Grief's a good example that also relates to denial. Some aspects of the grieving process are meant to, bring a person into contact with the reality of the loss that they have experienced, and our conscious awareness of that loss changes and fluctuates over time. And the goal, in some ways, of a grieving process is to be able to move forward with the reality of whatever's happened, and not that it fades into the background, but it becomes part of somebody's memory and consciousness, and they're able to move on. In terms of the, qualitatively, firstly, a lot of people access spirituality in times of grieving and times of mourning and loss. And, these sorts of things do bring up a spiritual concepts and themes. So many grief groups, grief support groups, like you mentioned, might have actual explicit spiritual meaning. But if not, I guess my main point then again was that, you know, as a cognitive frame, you know, if somebody thinks about their relationship with other people in their faith community as being, having a spiritual meaning, why they are there, so to speak, with that person, I think that's an additional, the propensity and potential for meaning making in such a circumstance, I think is in some ways greater than it is if the happenstance brought folks together in the secular context.
Yeah, there are some moments when you feel like this can't be a coincidence and the universe is just giving you a little high five or a low five. This the energy that I get from those moments, especially if I'm in a place where I'm losing hope in humanity, or at least getting very discouraged by the amount of darkness compared to the light, can be a really nice shot in the arm.
Yes, I think we all need a shot in the arm now and in general.
So is there, you know, as we look at the news and we see that the denial is having actual physical repercussions and threatening the rule of law in our country, how can we deal with it other than just resenting them and wishing that they weren't here?
I hope that's not our approach at all. I think that we all need to have a healthy dose of compassion and also validation, and to recognize that, let me ask you, had the election swung the other way, would you be in denial?
You know, that's a good question. I
maybe not to the extent of, you know, taking arms to Washington, but
right,
there would be a lot of people in denial, and myself included, who I don't know how I would feel. I don't know how I would feel.
I believe that I would feel that the election results were valid, because I do believe that there, you know, unless there was enough proof to show it otherwise, and certainly if these were taken before the courts, I would accept that those were the results, very unhappily, and I'd, you know, be filled with fear and resentment. But I don't know, you know, that is an interesting question. I think a lot of us experienced that in 2016. You know, how could this guy who bragged about sexually assaulting people, how could people still vote for him after that, even if they disliked the other candidate?
I think that we are all vulnerable. That's my main point, is that we are all vulnerable. Not only are we vulnerable, we all engage in this. This is part of the human condition. And I'm not even surprised by it. I mean, maybe I'm surprised by the extent of it. I didn't realize it would get this bad, but I'm not that surprised by the actual phenomenon. I think that's in some ways the main point here. And the only way I believe to move forward is by being compassionate and understanding that we're human. We're not perfect. And you know, if we siphon off everybody who doesn't seem to have a perspective that makes sense, mm-hmm. our world's become very small, very small.
One of the phrases that I found to describe when I can't get my head around something that somebody else believes is that, and I choose that I can't have a relationship with that person anymore, is that I say that our realities don't overlap enough that I can have a relationship with them. And I don't separate myself from them out of hate or bitterness. It's just, it's draining to me. And I feel that they, as wrong as I think they are, they should be given the dignity to have their own reality. It doesn't mean that I have to subject myself to it. But
I think that's a fine approach. If somebody says, listen, I just can't I don't know, the strength to be able to deal with this amount of tension, these difficulties. I have to focus on my area, I have to focus my energies on things that are more approximately close. But that's not denying, that's not wishing that they would go away, or it's just, I'd like to be close. I just don't have the energy. I don't have the capacity to handle this right now.
Yeah. One of the concepts that was kind of a revelation for me is I can have compassion for people at a distance. It doesn't mean I have to hang out with them. It just,
I think that's fair.
Anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up?
Only that I'm grateful to you for your many, many years of running this podcast and,
spreading
information and about mental health, and very many facets of mental health over the years to your audience members. And thanks very much for having me on your show.
It's my pleasure, truly. Many thanks to Dr. Ross Marin. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor turned patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Before we take it out with some surveys, I am reading a book that is so fucking fascinating. It's called Without Conscience, and it was written, God, probably 30 years ago, but it's about psychopaths. And anybody who is interested in psychopathy, it's one of the most compelling books I've ever read. And I've read other books on psychopathy, but this one is so good. And you can't help, as you read it, thinking this is the autobiography of Donald Trump. It is him to a T. To a T. I saw yesterday that Mike Pence is upset that Trump didn't call him to check up on him when he had been evacuated on January 6th. Really? That you were surprised by that? What? Have you not been paying attention for the last 4 years? That's like saying, I can't believe the wolf didn't save me any pizza. You know, you threw your lot in with him, man. I don't like to see anybody get hurt or be scared, but, you know, what you did, you knew he was a sick motherfucker that was the opposite of what quote-unquote Christian values are all about. And you threw your lot in with him. And how you can be surprised that the biting dog bit you. Anyway, enough of that. Let's get to some surveys. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by Jolene, and about her compulsive eating. She writes, food is like the loving caress I've been craving all my life. you for that. This is same survey filled out by Nothing But Nerves, and about their depression. Depression is the feral animal that's always tracking me. It nips at my heels and makes a home in my chest, suffocating me. ADHD makes me feel like everyone else was given a list of rules on how to act in the world, and I'm constantly having to pretend I know what the fuck I'm doing too, for fear of looking stupid. About anxiety. Anxiety is my most loyal companion, never leaving my side, even when I beg. About OCD. My fingers bleed, my gums bleed, my ass bleeds, but nothing is ever clean enough. Wow. Snapshot from her life. Because of past traumas and abuse, my childhood fear of being alone in a room for more than 5 minutes, would love to know where that stems from, resurfaced at 18. I am now almost 23, and though I've greatly improved over the years, I, without fail, every night, still have moments of panic when alone in the dark and must carefully listen for the sound of someone else breathing until I fall asleep. Sometimes I think I can hear it and will sit in horrible frozen panic until the sun rises. Holy fuck. Wow. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Dory shares about her depression, like having a vignette filter on life. There's always dark around the edges, and when the intensity is turned up, the dark covers the whole picture. Oh, that was a good one. Thank you for that, Dory. Who is this one filled out by? I don't have a name. Or is this part of this one? No. Someone writes about their PTSD, a fear of having my neck touched or watching someone else have theirs being touched, because even 20 years later, seeing it or feeling it brings me right back to being strangled in my sleep. Wow. Wow. About her son's schizophrenia. It's like seeing a person who died, someone you can physically touch, but no one is longer there. Wow. Wow. These are some heavy. I'm glad I'm sitting down for these. Fuck. This is such a good one about depression, filled out by Kay, the 28-year-old grown-up. And he writes about his depression, sitting down and doing a thing and feeling like I'm in the other room. Wow. Yeah, just feeling like a ghost. I think one of the hardest things being depressed is when you're around people who are happy and joyous. It's just, you feel so, it just highlights how down you feel. It's like watching the staff of Applebee's sing happy birthday to the potato famine. This is a happy moment filled out by V. And I love this one. She writes, one morning on my way to work, I stepped into my usual bus and saw something flutter by out of the corner of my eye. I didn't pay it any mind until a while later, the same thing landed on my shoulder. I turned to find a butterfly had landed there. For the rest of the ride, it stayed on my shoulder, and I was overcome with probably a bit of grandiose happiness at the idea that this little insect felt comfortable enough to stay on my shoulder when it could have landed on any other surface in the bus. At the same time, I worried about the rain outside and my approaching bus stop. Should I shoo it off before? Clearly, it wouldn't make it in the rain, but there was no food for it in the bus either. So I did what I usually do and decided not to make a decision at all. At my stop, I stepped outside the bus with the butterfly still stuck to my shoulder, doing my damnedest to hold my umbrella just right so no rain would touch my new companion. Close to my workplace, there were a few shrubs and trees, and the butterfly decided to cross the small distance and leave. Feeling grateful for the little guy having made my day, I turned back around and whispered goodbye in its general direction. Upon turning back around, I found a coworker approaching me. Normally, my socially anxious self would have been mortified at the idea of someone seeing me talk to a butterfly, or worse, plants, like a fucking Disney princess, but I still felt so happy at such a small shared moment with nature at the beginning of my day that I didn't care. I'm the queen of the butterflies, bitch. Yes. Oh, I fucking love that. Thank you for that one. This is from one of our surveys about older females sexually abusing younger males. And this was filled out by a woman in her 20s who calls herself, "I Still Carry the Shame." And she writes, "I was between the ages of 7 and 11. My childhood is very fuzzy, so I apologize for the lack of specificity. A young boy between 1 and 2 who was a child of a family friend was put under my care for a few hours. I was obsessed with sex when I was little. I started watching porn at a very young age, and the effects are still with me today. I knew that I would be watching him on another floor, so I took the chance to explore and learn about male anatomy. I wanted to know if a young child could get an erection. I remember touching, or at least trying to touch him a few times, and having him yell or get frustrated and then get upset. I also did this to a young boy I babysat around the same age when I was 10 to 12. I hate myself for what I did. I was the caretaker of these babies, and I took advantage of them and my power. I carry this guilt with me every day, and I get physically ill thinking of the trauma I may have left them with. It has been the catalyst to self-harm events and suicidal episodes throughout my life, and I am only 24. Words can never fix what I have done, but I just wish I could take away any pain or lasting traumas that I caused. I would carry that for them in a heartbeat. I am so sorry for what I have done. I have no sexual interest in children, and the idea makes me ill. So I just do not know why I did what I did back then. Have you ever told anyone? My therapist, but I never went into great detail. Remembering these things, what feelings come up? Shame, guilt, fear, pain. Do you feel any damage was done? I pray every day that there wasn't. She was also raised in a totally chaotic home and was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. And first of all, I want to thank you for going so deep and sharing such a personal and painful and shame-filled moment from your life. And I just want to say a couple of things. Number one, the important thing is that you're not that person anymore. And I know you know all this stuff intellectually, but sometimes it's nice to hear somebody say it out loud when we're, you know, feeling shame about a mistake we made or someone we hurt. And, you know, you harming yourself or committing suicide is not going to undo any of the stuff that you did. And we all make mistakes. You know, I have a history of objectifying women and using them for sex. And I'm ashamed of it. And there's few things in life I regret more than that. And I think about it almost every day. And I know that if I just sit and stare at the wall and hate myself, it's not going to make anything better. But if I try to become a better person, become more aware, and try little bits here and there to make the world a better place, you know, that's got to count for something. But self-forgiveness is really, really hard. And I just want to say, you were a child. You're not a monster. You have no desire to do that today, and that's what's important. You clearly have a conscience because it bothers you. And just sending you some love. And then finally, this is a happy moment filled out by a woman who calls herself, "Awfulsome will be my child's middle name." I love it. I want custody on the weekends. And she writes, "During the pandemic, my life has been flooded by a tidal wave of past trauma and mental disorders. But ironically, thanks to the very same pandemic, it has been the first time that I didn't have to deal with it entirely on my own, as my boyfriend moved in with me a couple of months ago, and our relationship has become much more sincere and intimate. My happy moment starts off pretty dismal. We were sitting on the couch watching The Crown together, a show that I love and that usually does a great job distracting me from the shit show that is reality. On this particular evening, however, images kept flashing before my eyes. Images of me cutting off my own fingers with a kitchen knife. Images of the bone sticking out and my stump fingers wiggling helplessly, blood gushing. I stiffened up and tried really hard to keep it together. I got a glass of cold water. I focused on my breath, to no avail. After the episode had ended, my boyfriend asked me if I wanted to watch another one or if I wanted to go to bed, considering it was past 1 a.m. already. I couldn't say a word. I just sat there for a couple of minutes, and he reached out to hold my hand. After a long, excruciating silence, during which I debated in my head whether it would be totally insane or insanely courageous to open up to him about it, I just did it. I told him about those images in my head. I told him that the sexual trauma from early childhood I had been remembering over the last couple of weeks was really freaking me out. I tried to describe the pictures to him, the kitchen knives, the stump fingers, and the naked boy standing in front of me looking at me. I started crying, and he held me, and I kept on talking. I told him I was really scared of my own mind and of the horrifying things my unconscious kept hurtling at me when I was least expecting it. He suggested we go on a walk. Some context. My boyfriend is the least spontaneous person on the planet. It takes him at least half an hour to make up his mind whenever he wants to get food or maybe just a coffee. So I was absolutely amazed. He got up and got my coat and hat. He even asked me if I wanted help lacing up my boots and if I need another pair of socks so my feet wouldn't get cold in the snow. He got two bottles of beer and stuck them in his coat pockets. He looked ridiculous. So we went on a walk at 2 a.m., me in my pajamas and coat, him with a bottle of beer in each pocket. The streets were deserted. We kept walking, sharing a bottle and holding hands to warm our freezing fingers. Drinking alcohol outdoors is illegal due to the pandemic. We felt like gangsters, like real cool kids. All the while, my boyfriend kept talking to me in such a steady and caring voice. He squeezed my hand. He made me laugh. It was the first time I ever shared the scary shit that is constantly going on in my head with someone else as it was happening. And he reacted so wonderfully. He didn't make me feel like I was too much. He let me know he cared. He did something really unexpected and out of his comfort zone to support me in this really tough moment. And he made me laugh so much that night. I've never felt so loved and so hopeful. I'm amazed that just by sharing my feelings with someone trustworthy and caring, a gruesome night that would usually have resulted in me self-harming, crying myself to sleep, etc., turned into the one of the most profound and beautiful experiences in my life. Wow. I live for surveys like this. It just, you know, sometimes all the other dark shit that I read in the surveys and I hear in the interviews and in my support group, sometimes it weighs on me a bit. And then I read something like this and it just, it's just like breathing oxygen. And then she also writes, is there any way to find out if there are other listeners of the show in Austria? I'd love to connect. Try going to the forum. Go to our website, metalpod.com. And go to the forum and post there. I've actually exchanged emails with somebody from Austria a while back. I believe I read one of her surveys. I think she lives on a farm in Austria. And I might be thinking of The Sound of Music. You know what I was? God damn it! No. If you go to the forum, I'm sure you can find somebody or email me, and I'll try to connect you. I hope you guys got something out of this episode, and just never forget, no matter what's going on in your brain, no matter how much the darkness is kicking your ass, you are not alone, you are not weird, you are not broken. There is always help in some form if we're willing to get out of our comfort zone and take that scary step of opening up to someone. And yeah, you're not alone, man. Thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful.
Everybody I know is
bizarrely beautifully
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.